Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sports Talk Chicago's 27th podcast. My name is John Zagluel, owner and operator of this site. Today, we have a lot to get to. The Bears hiring their new coach. The MLB Hall of Fame vote being announced on January 24th. We'll get to all of that and more. But first, just a few quick announcements. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports and hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram, all at John Zax. And finally, if you're looking for a place here in the Chicagoland area to book parties, paint your own pottery, and have art classes for both adults and children, check out the Arts and Crafts Studio by Moochie World, where inspiration meets creation. You can visit them at their website at moochieworld.com. Visit them at their store at the Tinley Park's Downs Shopping Center at 7913 West 171st Street in Tinley Park, or give them a call at 708-247-2100. Again, that's 708-247-2100. Well, we'll get started with some big news. In case you've been under a rock for a few weeks, the Bears recently finished their head coaching search. They hired Matt Nagy, formerly the Chiefs offensive coordinator, to become the team's next head coach. A little bit about Nagy, by the way. He was a former quarterback. He used to play for the Chiefs and then went to the Arena Football League. And in college at the University of Delaware, he still holds several passing records. And the reason I say this is because it'll relate back to Mitchell Trubisky, a very young quarterback whom Nagy can help mentor into the right direction. Something else about Nagy that I found pretty interesting, too, was the fact that he actually helped Alex Smith become more mobile in the pocket. Now, Smith with the 49ers, he was known to be a pocket passer. Even when he was drafted, he was considered a pocket passer. And I should say that many today feel the same way about him, even though this season he rushed for over 300 yards. And if you look at Smith's rushing statistics in his career, once he came to the Chiefs, his statistics really went up as far as rushing yards go. His first year with Kansas City, he rushed for 431 yards. That's the second best in his career. In 2015, he rushed for nearly 500 for his best mark. So Nagy, known for being a mobile quarterback, wants his quarterbacks to be athletic, be able to make plays with their feet, which is something that is becoming so mainstay today with many NFL quarterbacks. But anyways, about Nagy, I think this is a good hire for the Bears. The one thing I am worried about, however, when it comes to Nagy and his case, is the fact that he was the offensive coordinator, rather, under Andy Reid, a well-known offensive guru. I mean, this is a guy with the Eagles who really helped out Donovan McNabb and, at the time, Brian Westbrook, the running back, and they became a real tandem in the NFL. And obviously, this past season, you've got Tyreek Hill, Kareem Hunt, and Alex Smith over there in KC. So, Reid continually is making good players out of guys who may not be considered as good. Tyreek Hill was a punt returner and a kick returner this year at over 1,000 yards receiving. So, with that in mind, with Reid being the head coach, my question is, how much of a role did Nagy play in regards to offense? I mean, the situation, I think, would be different if, let's say, Nagy was on a team with a defensive-minded head coach, because he'd be playing a significant role. He'd be in charge of that offense. But with Andy Reid, an offensive-minded coach for the Chiefs, he was most likely calling these plays, or maybe he had the final say on certain plays. So I don't know how much of a role Nagy really played in the Chiefs and their offensive attack over these past couple of seasons, but nevertheless, I'm still very happy the Bears decided to make the right decision in choosing Nagy over somebody like Josh McDaniels. And I must say right away that I am just beyond thrilled that the Bears decided to pass on McDaniels. Yeah, let someone else have him, whether it's now the Colts or the Titans after the firing of Mike Mularkey, remains to be seen. But still, I am not a fan of Josh McDaniels, and this is why. To be perfectly frank, he just sucked as a head coach with the Broncos. And everybody's saying, oh, you know what, he's been with the Patriots now for a number of years. He's totally rebuilt his coaching reputation. And sure, you know, you could say whatever you want in regards to that opinion. But my thought is, I remember how horrible he was with the Broncos. Having Kyle Orton, i.e. another former Bear, by the way, he couldn't get anything done. They went 8-8 in his first year. Their offense was middle of the pack. I believe it's ranked 17th out of 32, so literally right in the middle. And then the next year, when I believe it was 3-9 before he got fired mid-season, McDaniels did horrible, totally bamboozled that team. He had a lot of talent, too. No Sean Marino, starting running back, and Buckhalter as his backup. Had a lot of talent on the offensive side, and it didn't work out for him. And before I finish ranting here on McDaniels, I also want to mention one thing. I don't know if anybody else has noticed this, but doesn't his relationship with Bill Belichick, and especially Tom Brady, remind you of another kind of love-hate or a feuding relationship in the world of college football? What about Nick Saban and Lane Kiffin? Doesn't that ring a bell? I don't know if that only applies to me, but I feel like their relationship between McDaniels and Belichick, a great coach and kind of a hard guy, you know, somebody who wants to make a name for himself on the offensive end, doesn't that remind you of Lane Kiffin and Nick Saban? And we all know what ended up happening there. Kiffin left, got his own coaching job, and he's doing okay. But the point is, that eerily similar situation combined with the fact that I just do not like McDaniels and I do not trust him after his one coaching stint with the Broncos makes me very happy that the Bears decided not to go after him. Again, have it be the Colts or Titans problem because I don't want it to be the Bears problem. Well, now that we're done talking about the Bears and their head coaching search, we're going to move on now, talk about some Bulls basketball. At the moment, they're 16-27. And they are 6.5 games out of a playoff spot, which, again, don't really want them to make the playoffs, right? We want them to continue to do okay or even a little subpar so they can get a good pick in next year's draft. So let's talk about a guy who I am starting to fall in love with more and more. I was a little skeptical at first, I'm going to admit it, because I felt that the Bulls could have drafted somebody more athletic and more menacing with their good pick that they had first round of the draft. But I've learned to like him, and that is Lauri Markkanen. What a year he is having. Probably one of the most consistent rookies out there right now in the NBA today, maybe with the exception of Ben Simmons, who is playing off the charts, nearly a triple-double, by the way, if you ever were interested or wanted to look up his own stats. But back to Markkanen, what a year he is having for the Bulls, and I feel like if it wasn't for him, this team would be almost unwatchable, because at this point, I know who Mirotić is, and although he's doing well for this team, there's nobody else on this team who's technically a household name. Somebody I would want to flip on the TV for and say, wow, you know, let me watch, you know, like a Luol Deng or a Ben Gordon, Derrick Rose, Noah back in those days. But Markkanen this year, what a year he's having. He's averaging over 15 points a game, over 8 rebounds as well. And that's coupled with the fact that he leads all rookies in 3-point field goals made. He actually is about to eclipse the 100 mark. He'll probably do that in the next game he plays. But thinking back to when the Bulls drafted him, I remember listening to talk radio, of course, here in Chicago the next day, and they were talking about a survey, right? A survey amongst draftees rating themselves, you know, who's the most athletic, who's the best scorer, the best passer, the best shooter, best rebounder, all of that. And I remember that Lauri Markkanen, as far as most athletic goes, was not even on the list. He only got one vote from his peers. I believe the leader was Dennis Smith Jr., and then obviously Jordan Bell. And by the way, we'll get to that entire situation in a minute, because I just want people to realize what Bell is doing right now with the Warriors is absolutely spectacular. He has now found himself starting on that team. But I digress, of course, going back to Markkanen. So none of his peers really felt that he had a good skill set for the NBA. Nobody thought he would be athletic enough to handle the NBA. And I remember, you know, listening to that, and I was like, you know what? I'm kind of a little mad here. The Bulls had a chance to get someone like Dennis Smith Jr., and they passed up on him for Lauri Markkanen? Who is this Lauri Markkanen anyway, right? He went to Arizona for a year, big old power forward slash center. People are saying he's going to be the next Porzingis. And at the time, I was like, you know what? No, I don't believe in him. And I remember on one of my podcasts way down there, back, I believe, in July, August, I was saying how, you know, Markkanen, I don't think, was going to live up to any expectations. Maybe he'd get a couple of minutes here or there, because at the time, we didn't have the fight with Mirotić or we didn't have the fight with Portis. They were going to be playing. And the question was, where is this kid even going to get time on the court? Then, of course, the fight happened. Mirotić and Portis suspended 8 games, and Mirotić out for 4 to 6 weeks due to a fracture in his face. So with that happening, the Bulls went to marketing by default and said, hey kid, you're going to come in, you're going to start. And what a job he has done to reserve that starting spot. Unfortunately, though, for marketing, he's not even getting any credit for what he's doing. Everybody's so worried about Lonzo Ball because of his father, even though Ball is averaging only 10 points per game, although he is averaging 7 assists and 7 rebounds, so I can't knock him too much. Worried about, you know, Kyle Kuzma with the Lakers. He's having a great year, by the way. And then Ben Simmons, of course, because he's the former number one pick who missed all of last season due to an injury. So technically, this year is his rookie year. So everyone's worried about these guys. Big-time market teams, their team's on the rise. Although the Lakers may not make the playoffs this year, they're still in L.A. And as for the 76ers, they're on the cusp. They're possibly going to get the 8th spot in the playoffs. So everybody's worried about these guys. Nobody is talking about how good Lauri Markkanen is playing. Now, you could counter, you can argue saying, oh, well, you know what, there's no one else on the Bulls, right? There's no one else on the team to carry the load, carry the brunt of the work. So, at that point, by default, it's going to have to be Lauri Markkanen. Who else would it be, right? Well, even though that may be the case, even though that there is no one necessarily on the Bulls who is of superstar status or guys who could just take over a game now that Butler is gone. But you have to remember, no matter who's on the team, no matter who's on the court, it's still a job getting done. And what I mean by that is, Markkanen is taking advantage of the time he's given. In my opinion, so what if there's no superstar in the team? You know what? That means Markkanen has to make a name for himself. And the responsibility is on him to become a superstar. And that's what he's really been doing. You can argue he's the best player on the team right now, and I wouldn't have a problem with that. He's doing very well this year, and nobody is taking notice because of how bad the Bulls are doing, because everybody's assuming the Bulls are in tank mode, which they are. But still, you have to recognize guys who are doing well. And Lauri Markkanen deserves to be recognized more so on a national scale. I know all of us in Chicago are recognizing him. We're watching the Bulls play every night. There's really no one else worthy of watching. Besides, maybe Markkanen, you can argue, possibly Chris Dunn or Mirotić and Portis. But still, Markkanen is having an amazing rookie season. Nobody is talking about it, and I want people to start talking about it. Talk about a hot take, am I right? Well, we're moving on now, going to the Chicago White Sox. And they've done a couple of things here throughout the offseason. I want to talk about some real quick. So, the White Sox right now, they just settled some salary cases. They avoided going to arbitration, and they haven't gone to arbitration, by the way, since 2001. So that's just a credit right there to the front office on getting work done in the deadlines needed. So they agreed to a one-year deal with Jose Abreu for $13 million. Lurie Garcia will be making $1.175 mil. Avilan, who the White Sox got in a three-team trade about a couple of weeks ago, he gets $2.45 mil. And Rodon gets $2.3 million. So, first off, these are all just one-year deals. These are raises that each player can get every year. That's how it goes when it comes to arbitration and all of that. But the more important thing, the more pressing issue here is Jose Abreu. Now, this year he's gotten a raise, but nevertheless, his contract is going to be nearly expired. And there has been a lot of trade talk around him as of late, from this past season to now, here in the offseason. So the question is, what are the White Sox going to do? Now, Abreu will be turning 31 on January 29th, last year. Amazing season. Actually, one of the best years since his rookie year, his first year in the league. He had 304, 33 homers, 43 doubles, and 102 RBIs. And for those who are sabermetrically inclined, a 906 OPS. And he led the AL in total bases as well. So he had an outstanding season. And proved to those who doubted him in regards to his regression over the past couple of years that he is still in the midst of his prime. He is still capable of hitting 30 homers, batting over 300. And speaking of that for a moment, I want to go back to that because I was not happy with the way people were talking about Abreu. Everyone was saying he was regressing, he was doing horrible. In 2015 and 2016, he hit .290, over .290 both years, still at 100 RBIs, hit 25 or more home runs, and at 178 or more hits. Now, although maybe it's not 36 home runs like in his rookie year, those are two great seasons for a first baseman. And everybody was trashing him, saying he's on a regression, he can't catch up to major league pitching, it's a sophomore slump, can't be doing this after his rookie year. He has been a model of consistency for this White Sox team over the course of these past 4 years. And for some reason, people were knocking him for that, I guess. But this past season, as I mentioned, he silenced everybody as he went back to his stats similar to those in his rookie season. And we just talked about Avila there for a moment. So the White Sox had a three-team trade with the Royals and the Dodgers. And in that trade, the White Sox got two relievers and cash considerations. So let's talk about the two pieces the Sox got. First, they got Luis Avila. Last year, good season, 2.93 ERA in 61 games for the Dodgers, and he averaged over a strikeout per inning pitched. They also got Joaquin Soria, and Soria, ironically enough, at one point in his career, used to be the closer for the Royals. He had multiple 40-save seasons under his belt with that team. So, how ironic is that? A former divisional foe now coming here to the South Side. And last year, Soria, 3.70 ERA, 4-3 record, in 59 games for the Royals, and as mentioned, 204 career saves. So, you know what, it wasn't a big trade, it wasn't something that's going to make, these huge headlines, but it gave the White Sox a couple of arms in the bullpen, something that they're going to need, especially during this long 2018 season when they're on the cusp of turning a corner, but they still have guys in the minors that are not ready to come up. So these guys are just more so stopgap options until the White Sox become contenders again, which won't be this coming season, but I could see it happening by 2019, and then, of course, everybody on social media saying 2020. So by then, the Sox will be a force to be reckoned with, but until then, talking about this trade, nothing more than getting some pieces to help the team just progressed through this season, using them as a stopgap. So with that, we'll move on now, start talking about the Chicago Blackhawks, and right now, 22-17-6, they have 50 points, they're 9 points off the division leader, the Winnipeg Jets, and right now they're on the cusp of making the playoffs. They hold the number 9 spot in the Western Conference, so they're close, they're not in yet. So let's talk about some headlines here. What's going on in Blackhawks world right now? Well, first, Patrick Kane has made another All-Star team. He is going to be a part of the Western Conference team once again. So, interesting news there. Of course, though, he's still deserving of it. He'll be the only Blackhawk, though, represented from this year's team in the All-Star game. This season for Kane, 45 games, 45 points, and also 18 goals, 27 assists. So another very Kane-like season for him, and he'll be going to the All-Star game, and well-deserved for him. And on a final note about the Blackhawks, and this is just in the NHL in general, I wrote an article on my site a couple of weeks ago talking about how integrity in sports is gone. I talked about, obviously, the steroids with baseball, talking about the NFL, the anthem protests, and the fact that the league is cover up information about CTE, the horrendous brain injuries that players can get after their careers are over. Then I talked about the NBA, and how in the NBA, nobody tries, and it doesn't matter what seed you get. If the Cavaliers and LeBron got the 8th seed, they could still win it all, which I find very, very horrible, very wrong. That gets rid of the competitive nature of the sport. And I just want to say, looking at the Hawks right now, they're 5 games over 500, and they're not even in playoff consideration. That just goes to show you that the NHL is a different animal than all those sports mentioned, because you know what? You still got to bust your butt to try and make the playoffs here. There is no guarantees in the NHL as far as making the playoffs goes, and I really like that about it. I like that concept because, again, in the NBA, you have teams finishing 5-6 games under 500, somehow sneaking into the playoffs. And here in the NHL, the Hawks are 5 games over 500. And right now, if the season ended today, they would not even be in the playoffs. So that's just, I had to get that off my chest. I wanted to mention that because that is so interesting and so good about the NHL and how they promote competition between teams still, even in the regular season. And on a final note, before we get to our special guest, this is something, this is an issue that is very near and dear to me, so I wanted to talk about this before we get done with this news part of the podcast, and that is the official BBWAA Hall of Fame vote for an MLB that's coming out. It's going to be announced on January 24th. We're seeing ballots now being publicized by many people. There's a tracker online where ballots are being publicized by certain writers and percentages are being added up, and then you've got predictions being made on who's going to get in. So I just wanted to use this time, go on my soapbox, speak to the chorus for a little bit about what I think about the Hall of Fame, who I think should get in. I have a ballot right here that I filled out, even though I have no say, obviously, in who gets in or not, but I have a hypothetical ballot that I filled out here, and I want to justify my picks. So, first of all, we're seeing a lot of people this year now starting to turn towards Bonds and Clemens and really starting to vote for them. Right now in the tracker, they're polling at 65-66%, meaning that eventually we could end up seeing these guys actually get into the Hall of Fame, if that's crazy enough. And I just want to say I disagree with that unbelievably. I am very, very disappointed that the voters now are turning to Bonds and Clemens and thinking, you know what, yeah, these guys are worthy of the Hall of Fame. I mean, sure, oh yeah, they use steroids, but you know what, who cares? Now, I understand the reasoning behind it, right? I mean, these two guys were, in fact, going to be Hall of Famers regardless of the use of steroids. Clemens, the year before he started using, I believe already had 190 wins, and was already at 3,000 strikeouts. That's crazy enough. And Bonds was at 400 homers and 400 stolen bases already before he started using steroids. But then they both made very bad decisions, decided to use the steroids, and their career numbers were inflated immensely. Obviously, Bonds is now the quote-unquote all-time home run leader. I don't care what you say. Hank Aaron, Henry Aaron, still in my heart, is the best home run hitter of all time. And then you've got Roger Clemens, who finished with over 350 wins. He finished third, I believe, yes, on the all-time strikeouts list. And, you know, you could say what you want about that as well. So I just want to say to those who decided to, for some reason, vote for Bonds, Clemens, any other steroid user on the ballot, that includes guys like a Sammy Sosa, or even a Manny Ramirez, too, in that case. Anybody who votes for a steroid person has no respect or no sympathy from me, because I believe that people who use steroids should not be allowed in the Baseball Hall of Fame. And I repeat, people who use steroids should not be near any Hall of Fame consideration. But with that in mind, you get 10 players on a ballot. So here is my hypothetical BBWAA official Hall of Fame ballot. I've got Chipper Jones, and the reason I say that is because why not, right? One of the best players in Braves history, over 400 home runs, one of the best switch hitters and third basemen of all time. Jim Thomae, another no-brainer, former White Sox, although he'll probably go in as a Cleveland Indian, but still, I mean, Thomae, 600 home runs, how can you argue with him not going in? Vladimir Guerrero, almost made it last year, he's going to get in this year. Great player. 450 homers, 2,500 hits. Of course, he comes short of the big, big milestones, but he's also an MVP winner, Gold Glover. Great player. Trevor Hoffman, 601 career saves. He was the first to get to 600 before Mariano Rivera passed him up, and I believe he'll get in this year. Edgar Martinez, and you know, the crowd goes silent. A lot of people are wondering. Look, Edgar Martinez had a very good career. He didn't have a lot of games under his belt, but the games that he did play in were very special. Career on-base percentage over 400, career batting average over 300, over 2,000 hits, over 300 homers, and I believe near 1,500 RBIs. In my opinion, I think he should get more consideration and should go in. Fred McGriff. Now, everybody, I'm sure everybody's wondering, why would I throw Fred McGriff on a ballot? I've gotten into heated debates with many people about why Fred McGriff, I think, should be in the Hall of Fame. You could say what you want. Oh, his metrics are horrible. Oh, you know, his WAR is at 50. Well, you know what? Here's one thing I have to say to counter that. 493 career home runs, 7 short of 500. You're going to tell me that somebody who hit 493 home runs does not deserve to go into the Hall of Fame? For crying out loud, Duke Snyder hit 407 and got in, and that was via the Veterans Committee. So I think that if McGriff maybe won't get in, you know, through the regular voting, he should get in on the Veterans Committee because I really, truly believe he deserves to be there. Next, I have Mike Mussina. That's another case. A lot of people are on the fence, right? 270 career wins, which is a very high win total, something that we may never even live to see again. I mean, with today's day and age, you know, pitchers not even going five innings, 300 wins is a stretch. Who knows if we'll ever see that again? 270 is pretty darn close, and Mussina could have even went longer and gotten to 300, but he retired early. And he had over 2,800 strikeouts. Again, less than 200 strikeouts away from 3,000. By being that close, I feel like Mussina has got to go in. Jeff Kent. Now, a lot of people, again, don't like that decision. I don't want Jeff Kent in the Hall of Fame. Here's what I have to say. He technically, if in all technicality, if you want to say so, was the best hitting second baseman of all time. He has the most home runs at the position, beating out Cubs Hall of Famer Ryne Sandberg, by the way. Sandberg had the record at 282. Kent had over 330 at the position, won an MVP award, and this guy is getting absolutely no consideration. I want to know why. I believe he deserves it. Kurt Schilling. Now, a lot of people don't like Schilling because of the way he is, how much of a jerk he is, and yeah, I mean, this guy has a radio show on BreitbartNews.com, so yes, he is a jerk, and I don't agree with anything that this guy has to say, but I will agree with this. His performance on the field deserves Hall of Fame merit. This guy struck out over 3,000 batters. Usually, that's automatic. You go in with 3,000 strikeouts. Won over 210 games, ERA around 3.50, and unbelievable postseason statistics, has three World Series rings, and is a co-MVP of the 2001 World Series. I think that he deserves to get into the Hall of Fame. And then finally, my 10th and final vote. A lot of people have written in players such as Larry Walker, whom I do not think deserves to get into the Hall of Fame, mostly because of the fact that he barely played any games. He was always hurt. Everybody's making a sabermetric argument saying his WAR is outstanding. Well, you know what? He played in Coors Field, number one. And number two, he barely played in any games. The guy couldn't even play in 150 games in the season. I believe he only did it four times. So when thinking about that, no way to Larry Walker. Gary Sheffield, an interesting case. I know people say he's tied to steroids, but looking into it, if you believe what he said, saying all he used was a cream for his knee and he had 500 home runs, then I think he deserves to get in. I mean, using a cream to get better, that's something different than simply injecting yourself with steroids for performance. He was trying to recover from an injury. So that's something else. And then finally, people are saying, let's put in Scott Rolen. And look, Rolen, again, sabermetrically, you can make a case for him. But as far as totals go, the guy was short of every offensive number. Defensively, he was a good player. But still, with those offensive stats, I cannot, in good conscience, elect him to the Hall of Fame. So, with my final hypothetical vote, I put in, drumroll please, Andrew Jones. Uh-oh. Everybody's freaking out, right? Andrew Jones, why should he get some merit here for a Hall of Fame vote? Two reasons why. Number one, 10 straight Gold Glove awards in center field. He was one of the greatest defenders of his time, and actually, although I probably don't agree with this, but if you go on baseballreference.com, look up best defensive WAR players in center field, he actually outpaces Willie Mays, which, again, that could be because of the fact that Mays played in a different time period, and the stats don't quantify, they don't equate. Still, though, Jones is ranked better. He's won 10 straight Gold Gloves. Okay, number one. Number two, in his prime, Andrew Jones was one of the best players in Major League Baseball. This guy smacked 50 homers a season. He ended his career with 434, so that's something else to keep in mind. I think that Jones deserves at least a look. Maybe not actually getting in, but I'll be one of the minority people who decided, you know, or who decides to vote for him. And I feel like he deserves a second chance. Now, the one thing that does hurt him, and I will agree with this, is he fell short of even getting 2,000 hits. I feel like if Jones could have played two or even three more seasons in baseball, Even as his status as a platoon player, he could have gotten to around 475 homers, maybe 2,100 hits. That would have really helped him to get more consideration, but still, I feel that Andrew Jones deserves a real good look, and I'm going to put him as my 10th and final vote on my hypothetical Hall of Fame ballot. So, there you go. And some other near misses, too, include Jamie Moyer. Say what you want about Moyer, but you know what? His stats are actually very similar to Jack Morris's, and Morris just got elected via the Veterans Committee. So, Moyer, another guy who just missed on my ballot, and also Johnny Damon. As crazy as that sounds, you know what? 2,800 hits. He was very close to 3,000. I think he at least deserves to get taken a look at. I'm not saying he is Hall of Fame worthy, but I think people should at least take a look at him before he falls off the ballot because of the 5% rule. So with all of that being said, my rant is over about the Hall of Fame, but I'm happy I was able to get that off of my chest because, again, I do not believe that guys who use steroids should deserve consideration for the Hall of Fame, so I just had to get that off my chest. I just had to say it, but happy that it finally got out. And with that, it's time for our special guest. He began his career in 1994, hosting a sports show on WTMJ AM in Milwaukee. He then transitioned into the booth, calling Beloit Snappers games while doing fill-in work for the Milwaukee Brewers. After calling two seasons of games for the Florida Marlins, he became the recognizable voice that all Chicagoans know today. Please welcome Len Casper, TV play-by-play broadcaster for the Cubs, to the show. And Len, how are you doing today? Awesome to have you on again. And, you know, by the way, this is the third time you've been on my show, so it's such an honor to keep having you on every year.
Happy New Year, John. Great to be with you. And always a good time to think about baseball with a lot of snow on the ground and pretty cold temperatures. But I think a lot of people are excited about the 2018 season coming up.
So before we get to 2018, I'd like to look back at the 2017 Cubs, a team which once again won the division, made the playoffs, but lost to the Dodgers this time in the NLCS. So in your opinion, being in the booth most of the regular season, or all of it rather, why did the team taper off a bit last year? Was it the loss of Dexter Fowler, a World Series hangover, fatigue, or something else? And I know you know this as well. I mean, after or going into the All-Star break, rather, the Cubs were under 500, so I mean, just crazy stuff going on last year. I can't even believe they came back to win the division.
Yeah, it was a really interesting year for a lot of reasons. I was not so sure that the World Series hangover actually existed, but after what we saw in the first half, I don't think there's any question that there was some mental fatigue and maybe some physical fatigue as well. Ben Zobrist recently related the story of how last winter he just did not have a normal off season because, you know, he had been in the playoffs and gone very deep the last several years and just didn't feel like he had prepared well enough for 2018. And I think that was just a natural course of events. When you play into November, you're a Chicago Cub, you win the World Series, all the accolades that come with that, and just the amount of energy you had to expend to get there. So, yeah, you're two games under 500 at the break. Kyle Schwarber spent some time in the minor leagues in the first half, which, you know, I don't think anybody really expected. There were some inconsistencies with the offense. But the second half was great. And to get to the NLCS for the third straight year and to feel disappointed that you didn't go beyond, I think is a really good sign for where this Cubs team is. I thought they were very resilient. I thought they came out of the All-Star break with a purpose. And, you know, they didn't run away with the division, but once they got on a roll, it was pretty apparent that they were the best team in the NL Central. And then the five-game series against the Nationals, that was a classic playoff series, one of the best I've ever watched, and Game 5 in particular was absolutely insane. So to win that series was huge. I thought the Dodgers were just a little better than the Cubs. And the Astros were probably the best team in baseball. So, you know, it was one of those seasons, John, where the Cubs kind of finished where they probably should have, and that is getting to the Final Four, but not quite getting to the top of the mountain again.
So you mentioned how, you know, the Cubs made it all the way back to the NLCS. People were disappointed. But here's something interesting. So this marked the third year in a row in which the Cubs won 90 or more games in a season, the last time a run like this happened in franchise history was during the years of 1928 through 1930. So, just from a philosophical standpoint, just to throw it out there, have we Cubs fans become too greedy? I mean, after winning it all, are we expecting too much from this team each year?
Well, I think that's natural, and that's the goal for a franchise, is to spoil your fans a little bit. I think John McDonough could talk about that with the Blackhawks. You start winning consistently, and whether you end up having a dynasty like the Patriots, or you just do what you just said, what the Cubs have done, I think it's natural for fans to raise their expectations. I don't think Theo Epstein minds that a bit, and I think he feels the same way, that it's World Series or bust, and you're right to feel disappointment when you don't get there. On the other hand, the big picture perspective is exactly what you said. This is pretty heady stuff in franchise history, and I've called it the golden era of Cubs baseball, and you know, I'm enjoying every minute of it, and I hope Cub fans everywhere are doing the same.
So, speaking of success, the Cubs have had a somewhat successful offseason so far. They got Brandon Morrow, a lucrative deal. He's going to possibly be the closer this year. Signing Tyler Chatwood, Steve Cechek, and yesterday it came out that the Cubs re-signed Brian Dunsing as well. So, first off, what are your thoughts on these signings? And then secondly, could we see another move coming?
Yeah, I like the bullpen moves a lot. Hector Rondon has moved on. Bringing Dunsing back, I thought was a real shrewd under-the-radar move. Cechek is kind of the funky right-hander, kind of a submariner, gives you a little bit of a different look. And then the Brandon Morrow move I like a lot. He will be the Cubs closer, barring any strange moves, which I don't anticipate in the bullpen over the next few weeks. Chatwood, a nice addition to the rotation, a guy whose non-Coors Field stats look pretty impressive, and I think when you take a guy away from the Rockies, there's a really good chance that his numbers are going to look a lot better. There could be another move out there. There are still some really good starting pitchers available, including the now former Cub Jake Arrieta, Yu Darvish, Alex Cobb. They're still all out there. So I think the Cubs would like to add another starting pitcher just to have some more depth. And if you can make that guy a top-of-the-line pitcher, even better. But I do think if the Cubs go into camp with what they have, they would feel pretty good at this point.
So, yeah, talking about depth and adding to that point, you know, a lot of the teams in the NL Central right now, they're upgrading a lot. I mean, the Cardinals got Marcell Ozuna. Brewers are adding depth to their starting rotation. And it was recently announced that Jimmy Nelson, who is technically the Brewers' ace, he's going to be coming back, I believe it was in May. So, for the Cubs, what needs to go right for them in 2018 in order to contend for another postseason appearance or even win the division? Because it seems like, you know, the Cardinals and the Brewers, they're just getting better.
Yeah, I mean, I think consistency and health in the starting rotation is obviously really important. And, you know, you think about your top three guys, you've got really three number ones, if you look at it that way, in that, you know, your opening day starter will probably be John Lester or Kyle Hendricks, but Jose Quintana could absolutely do it as well. So I feel really good about that part of the club. And then, you know, we mentioned the bullpen acquisitions. And then I just think offense, the consistency from some of the young players who are now maturing into the primes of their careers. You know, I don't think anybody expects any sort of issues from the Bryant and Rizzo tandem, that these guys are perennial MVP candidates and are kind of the bedrock of the lineup. But, you know, let's see Ian Happ in his second season adjusting to the adjustments that National League pitchers are going to make against him. Let's see Kyle Schwarber come back and now that, you know, he's past the issues he had. And I thought it was really good when he came back from AAA that he can kind of grow into the 35 homer, maybe 250, 260 batting average, high on base percentage guy that we saw when he started his career. Albert Elmora Jr., can he be an everyday center fielder? You know, that I'm really interested in watching. Ben Zobrist, I mentioned a down year last year, nearing kind of the end of his career. Probably will move around a little bit defensively. I expect him to have a really nice offensive season. And then Javier Baez, who really had the breakout year last year. You know, I will play a lot of second base, obviously. Will he play some third and Chris Bryant to the outfield? You know, all those questions remain to be answered in terms of defensive versatility. Wilson Contreras, you know, I think, John, he's got a chance to be an MVP candidate. You know, he has kind of laid down the gauntlet that he thinks he wants to be better than Buster Posey and Yadier Molina, and I'm not going to doubt him. You know, and I think the more confidence, the more experience he gains, he's got a chance to be one of the elite offensive and defensive players in the game today. So there's just so much potential offensively, and I think for it to come together would be enormous and could carry the Cubs to yet another division title.
Yeah, and adding to your point about Contreras, I mean, definitely you could see a bit of Molina in him, and for those Cubs fans out there, even a bit of, you know, Giovanni Soto back in his rookie year, that is. That year he did great too, so definitely. So I wanted to move on now, talk about a theory that's been going around. Of course, nothing's confirmed. Talking about Bryce Harper. Now, at Cubs convention this weekend, Chris Bryant talked about being a close friend of his. His name was frequented by Theo Epstein and others. So just freeballing it here, what do you think the odds are that the Cubs can acquire Harper, either by trade or by free agency?
Well, I don't see it happening via trade. What a team would have to give up to get Bryce Harper is, I can't even imagine what you'd have to part with, number one. Number two, the Nationals are probably going to run away with their division, and there's no reason they would even contemplate trading Bryce Harper unless all of a sudden this season turns into an utter disaster, which I'd have a hard time believing. They're incredibly talented, and I think they'll be playing in October under Davey Martinez here in 2018. So that's number one. Number two, in terms of free agency, there's just so much time between now and then that it's impossible to predict what will happen. I think Harper is positioned to probably garner the largest free agent contract in Major League Baseball history come next November. And the Cubs have a lot of depth in terms of their outfield and their position players. So, you know, until that changes, I just don't know. I think that certain things align. As you mentioned, Harper and Bryant are very tight. It looks like Harper's kind of had a little fun with playing this game, so to speak. But, you know, the Cubs right now, I think, are focused on this year and not necessarily next offseason. They would have the financial wherewithal, I think, to make a competitive offer to any of the top free agents out there. But let's just see how the season plays out, and Cub fans can dream about Bryce Harper in the outfield maybe next year.
So now, in regards to the game itself, in the next couple of weeks, we could be hearing about some possible rule changes in the MLB, including a possible pitch clock. Now, in my opinion, I think the beauty of this game is the fact that there is no clock or time limit. It makes it very unique. You know, NHL, MLB, or NBA, NFL all have clocks they run on. MLB, I mean, you could sit there and play for 3-4 hours and get through a game. You have to finish the 9 innings. So what are your thoughts on these possible changes?
I think pace of play is an issue. It's not the length of game that is the issue for me. It's the lack of action. I think we've gotten to a point where there are too many meetings on the mound due to the incredibly detailed scouting reports and pitch sequences the teams would like to have. I don't blame the managers, coaches, and players for these things, because it's a different game in that regard. But I do think it makes it tough for fans, particularly social media era fans, to stay engaged. And so I do think that we need to keep batters in the box, limit the visits to the mound. In terms of a pitch clock, you know, I'm not necessarily in or out on a pitch clock, but I do think pitchers need to pick up the pace a little bit. I just want more action, and we have too many parts of the game, especially now with replay, where it feels like we're standing around and waiting. And I just think that, you know, the NHL is obviously a fast-paced sport, but Some of the rules changes they implemented a few years ago have made that game, I think, incredibly appealing to watch in terms of lots of action, short stoppages in play. And I think MLB would be well served to maybe try to chop off 10 or 15 minutes off the game time just to compact the action a little bit more often during a game.
So I wanted to shift gears for a moment and reflect on your time with the Cubs. Now, 2018 will be your 14th season here on the North Side, and you're under contract through 2019. So what has this meant to you, being able to be a cherished part of a franchise over a decade? I mean, you came here in 05, and, you know, things weren't on the down, really. I mean, 05 and 06, you got to live through 07 and 08, and now watching the Cubs win a World Series. What has this meant to you after all these years still being here with the Cubs?
You know, I'm still pinching myself, to be honest with you, John. It's unbelievable to me to think that this job was even within my grasp. And I've told the story many times that when the job opened, I didn't apply at first because I didn't think I would have any prayer in the world in being considered. So, you know, just to get the job was something that I had never really even conceived in my mind. And now to be here as long as I have is an incredible honor. There's no franchise like it. There's no fan base like it in sports. There's no ballpark like it. The uniqueness of it is unparalleled, and I love every day I go to the ballpark. Obviously, when you're winning, it's a heck of a lot more fun. But I can honestly say, you know, 05, 06, as disappointing as those seasons were on the field, I had an absolute blast in the booth with Bob Brenly. The down years, the post-Blue Piniella years, and then the first few years with Theo here in the rebuilding mode. You know, those were fun seasons for me in that, you know that at some point it's going to get better, and to be able to see it grow kind of from the bottom up is appealing. It's not fun calling losses, not one bit, but it's always the greatest job in the world, no matter if the Cubs are the best team in baseball or the worst. And it's been very gratifying to see how this team has gone from a 100-loss club to now arguably the best team in baseball in a pretty short period of time. And I'm very, very appreciative that I was able to call a World Series championship season, the first the Cubs have had in well over a century. And I hope to call a few more here over the next few seasons.
So now, outside of the booth, you are an avid bass guitarist. You're playing multiple times in Theo Epstein's Hot Stove Cool Music benefit concerts. Now, I noticed on your Twitter account that on January 6th, you performed with The Diff at a venue in Chicago. You also dropped an instrumental track demo, which I really liked, by the way. It reminded me of a mix kind of between a contemporary, maybe like a Sting, and then maybe a classic rock element too, like a Pink Floyd. That was just my opinion, but can you tell us more about your recent concert, your demo, and your passion for bass guitar outside of broadcasting?
Yeah, you know, it's been something I've been into for a long time, and being able to play in the charity events you mentioned has really motivated me in my mid-40s, now mid to late 40s, to kind of get back into it. You know, I'm not getting any younger, and I really enjoy playing, and I love music, so being able to play in a band, The Diff, they asked me to join up, and we don't play very often, but, you know, it's something that I really enjoy doing. And I've written some songs on my own, and it's just kind of fun as a hobby. It's really purely selfish on my part. I like the stuff I'm doing. If other people like it, that's great. But it's just something that gives me a lot of, joy outside of, baseball. And, you know, you need a few things in your life that are totally separate from what you do for a living. I live and breathe baseball really for 8 months out of the year, and broadcast over 200 games when the Cubs make the playoffs, and that includes spring training. So it's just nice to have something on the other side of it to create some relaxation and to get some motivation to kind of get away from everything else for a few minutes.
So, on a final note, I wanted to ask you about something that I found quite hilarious. So, during a game against the Cardinals, the Cubs were trailing by 5 runs. You and JD were tossing bags of chips to fans seated near the press box. I remember watching this game, couldn't help but laugh. Why did you guys decide to do this? I'd love to hear the backstory.
You know, it's funny, I don't even remember it, that you bring it up, and it, this is a classic, story of someone enjoying a moment that we had and me having no recollection of it. Was it at Wrigley?
I believe it was.
Wow. Well, we must have gotten the bags of chips somehow, and I can tell you this, the part of the backstory is in Houston when JD was a broadcaster there, during the seventh inning stretch, the broadcasters there tossed bags of, potato chips and Cracker Jack into the section just below the booth. So it probably stemmed a little bit, from that. But it was more likely just, it was there and we decided to do it at spur of the moment. It was not planned, I can assure you of that, as we very rarely plan any of those moments, but I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Awesome. Well, Len, thank you so much here for being on the show, your third time on. Always a pleasure, always an honor to have you on, and thank you.
You got it, John, anytime.
So once again, a special thank you to Len Casper for being on the show. I ended up telling him off the air here that actually, on this date was the first time in which he came on 3 years ago, and since then he's really helped my website grow into what it is today. So again, thank you to Len for being here on the show. So now we're going to get to our closing segment, starting with the odd sports story of the day. This one coming from the HuffingtonPost.com. Here's the headline. Competition gets heated at Chile North Pole Marathon. One runner admits, quote, a beach in Miami. Sounds good right now. Wrapped warmly against the cold, a group of runners set off for the barren white landscape for one very cool race, the North Pole Marathon. Some 50 running enthusiasts from around the world braved harsh conditions for a 26.2-mile race on the frozen ice of the Arctic Ocean, staged at the Borneo Ice Camp. So all I have to say is this, I will never participate in something like that. That was your odd sports story of the day. Now we're going to move on to our punchline of the day segment. So here's the question. What is a Pittsburgh Steelers fan's favorite wine? The answer, we can't beat Jacksonville. And I had to say it, I'm sorry, but when Jacksonville with Blake Bortles beats you in the playoffs, you're going to get criticized a bit. That was your punchline of the day segment. And finally, my personal favorite, the announcer's call of the day. So let me set the mood for you here, tell you what's going on. This was on July 7, 2009. The Astros were at Wrigley Field facing the Cubs. The Cubs needed one run to win in the 13th. Bases were loaded, two outs. Alfonso Soriano at the plate. And here's our guest, Len Casper, with the call.
Fly ball with any depth to it wins it. In the air, and that will do it. Deep to center for Soriano. Got a grand slam. They only needed one. They got four. They win it 5-1.
What a call there by Len Casper. I actually remember watching that game. It was during the summer, so I was allowed to stay up and see it. And what an ending, what a finish, what a team. Well, that does it for us here at Sports Talk Chicago. Thank you all for listening to the show. Please make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports. Hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram, all at John Zags as well. And make sure to subscribe to the website so that way you can get email updates about when new content is posted. Thank you all again for listening, and have a great day.